once more, we thank Fran Luck for a production of the Women's Rally earlier this week that we heard in the first half of the show, and urge you to tune in for more on that subject this August 31st at 9 p.m. on WBAI for Joy of Resistance. And now, stay tuned for Hour of the Wolf with Jim Froyen. In New York, I'm Robert Knight for Earthworm.
Earthwatch was brought to you with portions on recording. Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday night program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, well, it's a pretty free-form show, but I do think that we're going to include The Game of Rat and Dragon by Cord Wiener-Smith. Stay tuned. Good morning. As mentioned, this is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund, and I don't have an agenda this morning. Last week, Keith DeCandido was here. 2 weeks ago, we had various geeks doing commentary and stuff about their new book called Geek Wisdom. Stephen Siegel, the editor, along with, well, various folk. And this morning, I haven't set an agenda. I didn't bring any specific recordings with me. I did bring a favorite short story, which I think I will read for you. Probably not too long, but I have a bigger question for people, because I was thinking on my way in. I mean, I had a lot of fun with the Geek Wisdom show when some people like Genevieve Valentine, who was here on that show, and others come in. Sometimes it's fun just to talk about the latest movies and things like that, you know, which does not fall into what has been, since 1972, much of the Hour of the Wolf format. Let me rephrase that. In 1972, when Margot Adler started Hour of the Wolf, the show was on the air 5 days a week, and Thursdays and Fridays were the science fiction mornings. She was the host 5 days a week. I was the co-host on Thursdays and Fridays, although I tended to engineer Monday through Wednesday anyway, or at least be there. And when I took over the show in 74, that format stayed more or less. Eventually, I cut myself down to 2 days a week, and, you know, helped find other wonderful people for the other shows, which included Joan Hervey, Richard Fioravanti, various folk. And for the 5 to 7 weekday slot, Gary Fried did the weekend, which was actually 5 to 8:30, which was eventually inherited by Simon Lokely. I was eventually cut down to 1 day a week. Now, when I had 2 shows a week, I was doing science fiction one day and freeform the other day, which might include the science fiction stuff, or not. I'd talk about anything I liked. And then I was moved out of weekdays into Saturday mornings. I went kicking and screaming. Steve Erickson, the program director at the time, and one of Simon's best friends then and now, bisected Simon's show. He cut Simon's show from 5 to 8:30, putting me in from 5 to 7, a time slot which I grew to love and kept for 20 years until last October, when it was more or less canceled with a promise to find me something else. And then in November, this time slot was opened for me by taking away half an hour from Robert Knight's slot. Normally, Robert would be on till 2 a.m., but I was given 1:30 to 3. Okay, so so I've gone from 10 hours a week, 5 days a week, through many, many years. Not a sudden thing. To 90 minutes. And sometimes I get a hankering for just going totally freeform, for just talking about anything I like. I could talk this morning about, people may know that I occasionally make my living as either a tech support person or as a journalist in the world of personal technology, be it computers, internet, whatever. I do some web design, things like that. And, you know, the fact that Steve Jobs has resigned is something that, well, it's going to change the world. We knew it was coming. But for better or worse, and those who really know me know that I'm not a pro-Apple person. In fact, very much not. Very much not. Much more in favor of either open source and other things. I consider Apple a monopoly. They make the hardware. With the new operating system, you can only buy the software through the hardware. It's all complicated. At any rate, I don't want to get into that now. But the point is, I could. But then, but I could also talk about the latest movies, TV shows, the fact that, I should mention it, that Doctor Who begins again on television this coming Saturday. And, nah, yeah, you think that Riversong is Amy's daughter? There are very heavy clues around that that is misdirection. It'll be a very interesting second half to, well, either the 6th or the 32nd, I think it's the 32nd season, depending on how you count. Do you count from the beginning of the series and, you know, then take off the years when it wasn't off the air and then count again? Or the way the BBC currently does it is that this is the 5th or 6th season, which... Let's see, no, Eccleston 1 year, Tennant 3 years, plus that, was it 2 years plus a semi, or was it 3 years plus the semi? I think it was 2 years plus a semi, making this actually the fifth. Oh, and then the full Matt Smith season, and now this is the second half. So it's the 6th season. Whatever. I could be talking about that and doing those things and saying, yeah, that's all Hour of the Wolf. The show isn't even broadcast in the Hour of the Wolf anymore. But the name, and I'm, you know, I'm not giving up that name since it has been that since 1972. So anyway, the question has been coming up in my head, and I am going to do science fiction this morning, but then I'm also going to just take calls and chat with you about various things. And one of the things I really want to chat with you about, and Sydney Smith, who was here, still is here, but was in this room, and I were talking, he said, do what you're comfortable with. And yeah, I'm totally comfortable talking to you, the listeners, and asking your opinion. Should I widen the format of the show and just be in general the geek that I am and talking about the geeky things in which I'm interested? Should I stick to science fiction fantasy? Should I stick to what I have always stuck to, which is the literature of speculative fiction? I'm not sure. I would like to talk about it. And Sydney pointed out, I'm going to talk about it with you. So that's on the agenda for later this morning. First thing is, let's see, announcements. Yes, this is a very, very, very cool one. A person who's been a guest twice since the show's moved here in November and was, in fact, the very first guest on the new Hour of the Wolf. You know how David Letterman, when he goes and starts a new show, be it CBS or NBC or wherever, he has on Billy Crystal. I go with Rick Bowes. And one of Rick's best stories of all time is a September 11th related story called There's a Hole in the City. And Janet Coleman and David Dozer, who do the next hour on Sunday mornings at 11 a.m., talked with the powers that be here and are about the only show that are actually keeping their time slot on Sunday, September 11th. They will be out of... They have agreed with me to produce it. I will be hosting that morning and producing it. And, well, here's a promo.
There's a Hole in the City by Richard Bowes. Wednesday, 9:12:01. On the evening of the day after the towers fell, I was waiting by the barricades on Houston Street on LaGuardia Place.
On Sunday, September 11th, as part of WBAI's special anniversary programming, the next hour, with guest host Jim Freund, will feature this award-winning story, followed by an interview with Rick Bowes and the preeminent psychologist on contemporary terrorism, Dr. Charles B. Strozier. That's September 11th at 11 a.m. on the next hour, featuring Richard Bowes reading There's a Hole in the City.
I mean, that's just way cool that we're doing that. And I am so ever grateful to Janet Coleman, David Dozer, and the powers that be at WBAI. How often do you hear that? Well, I'm very pleased with that. So now you know. And that's a great story, by the way. And this fellow Charles Strozier is a fascinating guy. He is a psychoanalyst with specialty of dealing with how people react to apocalyptic situations. So it's the large and the small all at once, which is really what There's a Hole in the City is all about. So that'll be a special hour, and I do hope that you tune in. You'll remember the date. It's September 11th. And at 11 a.m., so there's, you know, 9-11-11 at 11. Simple enough. Okay. So I'm going to read a story, but you know what? You know, I didn't bring myself. I should have brought myself a little cup of water if I'm going to read a story for about half an hour. I ought to have something in front of me, right? I didn't have time to do that during the during that promo. So, I'm going to play a cut of music. What am I going to play? I didn't bring my musics with me. I have one song that I play a lot, and I love it. So I'm going to play it again. This one goes to 1921.
Say, did you ever hear the saxophone let out an awful moan, let out an awful groan? It makes you feel so nervous, yet it's great. It's the saxophone a-calling to his mate. That's sweet coquette, the clarinet. Now listen for a minute, and the birth of jazz you'll hear. And where there is a little jazz, you'll always find me dear. For I'm a jazz vampire. Shake a foot, with me and dance, dance. Dancing is my specialty. Wise men keep bottom away. They know I'll lead them astray. They fall the minute I sway. I insist you can't resist a jazz vampire. Take a tip from me, for I am all that evil music has. Went down to the river, stood on a bank, shook my shoulders and the boat all sang. For I'm the meanest kind of jazz vampire. I'm the wicked vampire of the jazz. Get up in the morning and I make the coffee roll. Ham and egg turn over, put the crullers in a hole. Get up on a trolley car, the car begins to sway. I sit upon a half a dozen laps to start the day. I walk into the office and I greet the starter there. Six or seven elevators go up in the air. Sit down at my Remington and syncopate the keys. The fellow by the water stand gets water on the knees. The boss dictates a letter. Dear sir, I'd like to say, the man who gets the letter has to stop and hesitate. Now when the day is over and the sun sets in the west, say I'm the only little bird who doesn't go to rest. For I'm a jazz vampire. Take a tip from me, for I am all the evil music has. I stood by the ocean, no one around, shook my shoulders and the sun went down. For I'm the meanest kind of jazz vampire.
Marion Harris, 1921. I'm a jazz vampire. I love that song so much. This is WBAI in New York City, listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. This is Hour of the Wolf. And again, I am Jim Freund, and I am going to read you a story by one of the most fascinating people ever to work in the fields of science fiction and fantasy. And this is actually a science fiction story. I refer to science fiction, but by that, that's often fantasy, that's often horror. It's a very, very loose name for a very generalized genre. Steampunk is science fiction. Lord of the Rings is not science fiction, but it is certainly within the genre. You know, where do you begin? Where do you end? Star Wars is science fantasy, right? You know, because it's just fantasy, and yet it's science fiction. Also, it's what they call science fantasy. This is actually a science fiction story. Cordwainer Smith was the pseudonym of Dr. Paul Leinbarger, who was an eccentric gentleman, walked around wearing a kimono, taught political science at Columbia University, along with James Tiptree Jr., who was actually a woman by the name of Alice B. Sheldon. Both of them kept their identities secret for many years. In her case, really, the secret only came out about a year or two before her death. And her death was a gory suicide, shotgun. She killed her husband and then herself. Her husband had Alzheimer's, and she decided, and they were elderly, and she decided that was it for them. Leinbarger, well, maybe after the reading, I can get into some of his bio, but was just a fascinating gentleman who consulted for the State Department. He was a person during World War II. He came up with a method by which certain Japanese soldiers could say that I surrender would not have honor, okay? It was something that they could not say or do. It was just not within what these folk were trained culturally to do. And Cordwainer Smith, or rather Paul Leinbarger, came up with a phrase that to an American sounded like I surrender, and to them means, you know, I greet you in an honorable fashion and do not wish to fight, which would prevent death and still allow honor, and would also tell an American who couldn't understand a word of Japanese anyway that this is a person who isn't going to fight. That was a famous example. I don't know how apocryphal or not, but it's a famous example of the kind of thinking and facility Leinbarger did. He had all of these languages. Fascinating man. But he never became a big, big name, which is why there is an annual award given out. The Cordwainer Smith Award is for writers who are not remembered, even though they had a major impact and wrote excellent, excellent fiction in their time. This is one of Cordwainer Smith's most famous stories. He built this huge universe, which is probably best called the Instrumentality of Mankind. It involved a couple of novels. Nostrilia is one. I don't recall the name of the other offhand. And maybe about 20 or 30 short stories. Most of these are available, by the way, in one volume from NESFA, N-E-S-F-A. The New England Science Fiction Association. And there's also a volume, I don't know if it's in print or not, I'll look that up, called The Instrumentality of Mankind. But just start with the name Cordwainer Smith and look really for the short story collections. The novels are, I wouldn't say disposable, but they're not the same. And one story builds upon the other, upon the next, and this whole vast epic history that begins pre-World War II and goes into several thousand years into the future is fascinating. Here is a story that's set probably several hundred years from now. And it is called The Game of Rat and Dragon. Captain Wow and the other feline characters were inspired... Oh, this is an intro. I am terribly sorry. Well, let me read you the intro. Captain Wow and other feline... No, I'm not going to read you the intro. That's giving away too much. Let me just give you the words by Cordwainer Smith. The Game of Rat and Dragon, Part 1. The Table. Pin lighting is a hell of a way to earn a living. Underbill was furious as he closed the door behind himself. It didn't make much sense to wear a uniform and look like a soldier if people didn't appreciate what you did. He sat down in his chair, laid his head back in the headrest, and pulled the helmet down over his forehead. As he waited for the pin set to warm up, he remembered the girl in the outer corridor. She had looked at it, and then looked at him scornfully. Meow. That was all she had said. Yet it had cut him like a knife. And what did she think he was? A fool? A loafer? A uniformed non-entity? Didn't she know that for every half hour of pin lighting, he got a minimum of 2 months' recuperation in the hospital? By now, the set was worn. He felt the squares of space around him, sensed himself at the middle of an immense grid, a cubic grid, full of nothing. Out in that nothingness, he could sense the hollow, aching horror of space itself and could feel the terrible anxiety which his mind encountered whenever it met the faintest trace of inert dust. As he relaxed, the comforting solidity of the sun, the clockwork of the familiar planets, and the moon rang in on him. Our own solar system was as charming and as simple as an ancient cuckoo clock filled with familiar ticking and with reassuring noises. The odd little moons of Mars swung around their planet like frantic mice, yet their regularity was itself an assurance that all was well. Far above the plane of the ecliptic, he could feel half a ton of dust more or less drifting outside the lanes of human travel. Here, there was nothing to fight, nothing to challenge the mind, to tear the living soul out of a body with its roots dripping in effluvium as tangible as blood. Nothing ever moved in on the solar system. He could wear the pin set forever and be nothing more than the sort of telepathic astronomer, a man who could feel the hot, warm protection of the sun throbbing and burning against his living mind. Woodley came in. "Same old ticking world," said Underbill. "Nothing to report. No wonder they didn't develop the pin set until they began to planiform. Down here with the hot sun around us, it feels so good and so quiet. You can feel everything spinning and turning. It's nice and sharp and compact. It's sort of like sitting around home." Woodley grunted. He was not much given to flights of fantasy. Undeterred, Underbill went on. "It must have been pretty good to have been an ancient man. I wonder why they burned up their world with war. They didn't have to planeform. They didn't have to go out to earn their livings among the stars. They didn't have to dodge the rats or play the game. They couldn't have invented pin lighting because they didn't have any need of it. Now, did they, Woodley?" Woodley grunted. "Uh-huh." Woodley was 26 years old and due to retire in one more year. He already had a farm picked out. He had gotten through 10 years of hard work pin lighting with the best of them. He had kept his sanity by not thinking very much about his job, meeting the strains of the task whenever he had to meet them, and thinking nothing more about his duties until the next emergency arose. Woodley never made a point of getting popular among the partners. None of the partners liked him very much. Some of them even resented him. He was suspected of thinking ugly thoughts of the partners on occasion, but since none of the partners ever thought a complaint in articulate form, the other pinlighters and the chiefs of the instrumentality left him alone. Underbill was still full of the wonder of their job. Happily, he babbled on. "Well, what does happen when we planoform? To us, what happens? Do you think it's sort of like dying? Did you ever see anybody who had his soul pulled out?"
Pulling out souls is just a way of talking about it, said Woodley. After all these years, nobody knows whether we have souls or not. But I saw one once. I saw what dog would look like when he came apart. There was something funny. It looked wet and sort of sticky, as if it were bleeding and went out of him. And you know what they did to Dogwood? They took him away, up in that part of the hospital where you and I never go. But way up at the top part where the others are. Well, the others always have to go if they're alive after the rats of the up and out have gotten them. Woodley sat down and lit an ancient pipe. He was burning something called tobacco in it. It was a dirty sort of a habit, but it made him look dashing and adventurous. Look here, youngster. You don't have to worry about that stuff. Pin lighting is getting better all the time. The partners are getting better. I have seen them pin light two rats 46 million miles apart in 1.5 milliseconds. As long as people had to try to work the pin sets themselves, there was always the chance of the minimum of 400 milliseconds for the human mind to set a pin light. We wouldn't light the rats up fast enough to protect our planoforming ships. The partners have changed all that. Once they got going, or once they get going, they're faster than rats, and they always will be. Now, I know it's not easy letting a partner share your mind. Well, it's not easy for them either, said Underbill. Don't worry about them. They're not human. Let them take care of themselves. I've seen more pin lighters go crazy from monkeying around with partners than I ever have seen caught by the rats. How many of them do you actually know of that got grabbed by rats? Underbill looked down at his fingers, which shone green and purple in the vivid light thrown by the tuned-in pin set, and counted chips. The thumb for the Andromeda, lost with crew and passengers, the index finger and middle finger for release ships 43 and 56, found with their pin sets burned out and every man, woman, and child on board found dead or insane. The ring finger, the little finger, and the thumb of the other hand were the first three battleships to be lost to the rats, lost as people realized that there was something out there, underneath space itself, which was alive, capricious, and malevolent. Planoforming was sort of funny. It felt like, well, like nothing much, like the twinge of a mild electric shock. Like the ache of a sore tooth bitten on for the first time, like a slightly painful flash of light against the eyes. Yet in that time, a 40,000-ton ship lifting free above Earth disappeared somehow or other into two dimensions and appeared half a light year or 50 light years off. At one moment, he would be sitting in the fighting room, the pin set ready and the familiar solar system ticking around in his head. For a second, or a year, he could never tell really how long it was objectively, the funny little flash went through him and he was loose in the up and out, the terrible open spaces between the stars, where the stars themselves felt like pimples on his telepathic mind, and the planets were too far away to be sensed or read. Somewhere in this outer space, a gruesome death awaited, death and horror of a kind, which man had never encountered until he reached out for interstellar space itself. Apparently, the light of the suns kept the dragons away. Dragons. That was what people called them. To ordinary people, there was nothing, nothing except the shiver of planoforming and the hammer blow of sudden death or the dark, spastic note of lunacy descending into their minds. But to the telepaths, they were dragons. In the fraction of a second between the telepath's awareness of a hostile something, out in the black, hollow nothingness of space and the impact of a ferocious, ruinous psychic blow against all living things within the ship, the telepaths had sensed entities, something like the dragons of ancient lore. Beasts more clever than beasts, demons more tangible than demons, hungry vortices of aliveness and hate, compounded by unknown means out of the thin, tenuous matter between the stars. It took a surviving ship to bring back the news, a ship in which, by sheer chance, a telepath had a light beam ready, turning it out at the innocent dust, so that, within the panorama of his mind, the dragon dissolved into nothing at all, and the other passengers, themselves non-telepathic, went about their way not realizing that their own immediate deaths had been averted. From then on, it was easy. Almost. Planoforming ships always carried telepaths. Telepaths had lost their sensitiveness, enlarged to an immense range by the pinsets, which were telepathic amplifiers adapted to the mammal mind. The pinsets, in turn, were electronically geared into small dirigible light bombs. Light did it. Light broke up the dragons, allowed the ships to reform three-dimensionally, skip, 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 as they moved from star to star. The odds suddenly moved down from 100-1 against mankind to 60-40 in mankind's favor. Well, this was not enough. The telepaths were trained to become ultra-sensitive, trained to become aware of the dragons in less than a millisecond. But it was found that the dragons could move a million miles in just under 2 milliseconds, and that this was not enough for the human mind to activate the light beams. Attempts had been made to sheath the ships in light at all times. This defense wore out. As mankind learned about the dragons, so too, apparently, the dragons learned about mankind. Somehow they flattened their own bulk and came on extremely flatter trajectories very quickly. Intense light was needed, light of sunlight intensity. This could be provided only by light bombs. Pin lighting came into existence. Pin lighting consisted of the detonation of ultra-vivid miniature photonuclear bombs, which converted a few ounces of magnesium isotope into pure visible radiance. The odds kept coming down in mankind's favor, yet ships were being lost. It became so bad that people didn't even want to find the ships because the rescuers knew what they would see. It was sad to bring back to Earth 300 bodies ready for burial and 200 or 300 lunatics damaged beyond repair to be awakened and fed and cleaned and put to sleep, wakened and fed again until their lives were ended. Telepaths tried to reach into the minds of the psychotics who had been damaged by the dragons, but they found nothing there beyond vivid spouting columns of fiery terror bursting from the primordial id itself, the volcanic source of life. Then came the partners. Man and partner could do together what man could not do alone. Men had the intellect, partners had the speed. The partners rode their tiny craft, no larger than footballs, outside the spaceships. They planoformed with the ships. They rode beside them in their 6-pound craft, ready to attack. The tiny ships of the partners were swift. Each carried a dozen light pins, bombs no bigger than thimbles. The pin lighters threw the partners, quite literally threw, by means of mind-firing relays, directly at the dragons. What appeared to be dragons to the human mind appeared in the form of gigantic rats in the minds of the partners. Out in the pitiless nothingness of space, the partners' minds responded to an instinct as old as life. The partners attacked, striking with a speed faster than man's, going from attack to attack until the rats or themselves were destroyed. Almost all the time, it was the partners who won. With the safety of the interstellar skip, skip, skip of the ships, commerce increased immensely. The population of all the colonies went up, and the demand for trained partners increased. Underbill and Woodley were part of the third generation of pinlighters, and yet to them it seemed as though their craft had endured forever. Gearing space into minds by means of the pin set, adding the partners to those minds, keying up the minds for the tension of a fight on which all depended. This was more than human synapses could stand for long. Underbill needed his 2 months' rest after an hour of fighting. Woodley needed his retirement after 10 years of service. They were young. They were good. But they had limitations. So much depended on the choice of partners, so much on the sheer luck of who drew whom. Part 2. The Shuffle. Father Moontree and a little girl named West entered the room. They were the other two pinlighters. The human complement of the fighting room was now complete. Father Moontree was a red-faced man of 45 who had lived the peaceful life of a farmer until he reached his 40th year. Only then, belatedly, did the authorities find that he was telepathic and agreed to let him, late in life, enter upon the career of pinlighter. He did well at it, but he was fantastically old for this kind of business. Father Moontree looked at the glum Woodley and the musing Underbill. "How are the youngsters today? Ready for a good fight?" "Father always wants a fight," giggled the little girl named West. She was such a little girl. Her giggle was high and childish. She looked like the last person in the world one would expect to find in the rough, sharp dueling of pin lighting. Underbill had been amused one time when he found one of the most sluggish of the partners coming away happy from contact with the mind of the girl named West. Usually the partners didn't care much about the human minds with which they were paired for the journey. The partners seemed to take the attitude that human minds were complex and fouled up beyond belief anyhow. No partner ever questioned the superiority of the human mind, although very few of the partners were much impressed by that superiority. The partners liked people. They were willing to fight with them. They were even willing to die for them. But when a partner liked an individual the way, for example, the Captain Wow or the Lady May liked Underbill, the liking had nothing to do with intellect. It was a matter of temperament, of feel. Underbill knew perfectly well that Captain Wow regarded his, Underbill's, brains as silly. What Captain Wow liked was Underbill's friendly emotional structure, the cheerfulness and glint of wicked amusement that shot through Underbill's unconscious thought patterns, and the gaiety with which Underbill faced danger. The words, the history books, the ideas, the science, Underbill could sense all that in his own mind, reflected back from Captain Wow's mind as just so much rubbish. Miss West looked at Underbill. "I bet you've put Stick'em on the stones." "I did not." Underbill felt his own ears grow red with embarrassment. During his novitiate, he had tried to cheat in the lottery because he got particularly fond of a special partner, a loving young mother named Myrrh. It was so much easier to operate with Myrrh, and she was so affectionate toward him that he forgot pin lighting was hard work and that he was not instructed to have a good time with his partner. They were both designed and prepared to go into deadly battle together. One cheating had been enough. They found him out, and he had been laughed at for years. Father Moontree picked up the imitation leather cup and shook the stone dice which assigned them their partners for the trip. By senior rights, he took first draw. He grimaced. He had drawn a greedy old character, a tough old male whose mind was full of slobbering thoughts of food, veritable oceans full of half-spoiled fish. Father Moontree had once said that he burped cod liver oil for weeks after drawing that particular glutton, so strongly had the telepathic image of fish impressed itself upon his mind. Yet the glutton was a glutton for danger as well as for fish. He had killed 63 dragons, more than any other partner in the service, and was quite literally worth his weight in gold. The little girl, West, came next. She drew Captain Wow. When she saw who it was, she smiled. "I like him. He's so much fun to fight with. He feels so nice and cuddly in my mind." "Cuddly, hell," said Woodley. "I've been in his mind, too. It's the most leering mind in this ship, bar none." "Nasty man," said the little girl. She said it declaratively, without reproach. Underbill, looking at her, shivered. He didn't see how she could take Captain Wow so calmly. I mean, Captain Wow's mind did leer. When Captain Wow got excited in the middle of a battle, confused images of dragons, deadly rats, luscious beds, the smell of fish, the shock of space all scrambled together in his mind as he and Captain Wow, their consciousnesses linked together through the pin set, became a fantastic composite of human being and Persian cat. Well, that's the trouble of working with cats, thought Underbill. It's a pity that nothing else will serve as a partner. And cats were all right once you got in touch with them telepathically. They were smart enough to meet the needs of the fight, but their motives and desires were certainly different from that of humans. They were companionable enough, as long as you thought tangible images at them, but their minds just closed up and went to sleep when you recited Shakespeare or Colgrove, or if you tried to tell them what space was. It was sort of funny realizing that the partners who were so grim and mature out here in space were the same cute little animals that people had used as pets for thousands of years back on Earth. He had embarrassed himself more than once while on the ground saluting perfectly ordinary non-telepathic cats because he had forgotten for the moment that they were not partners. He picked up the dice and shook them out. He was lucky. He drew the Lady May. The Lady May was the most thoughtful partner he had ever met. In her, the finely bred pedigree mind of a Persian cat had reached one of its highest peaks of development. She was more complex than any human woman, but the complexity was all one of emotion, memory, hope, and discriminated experience. Experience sorted through without benefit of words. When he had first come into contact with her mind, he was astonished at its clarity. With her, he remembered her kittenhood. He remembered every mating experience she had ever had. He saw in a half-recognizable gallery all the other pinlighters with whom she had been paired for the fight, and he saw himself, radiant, cheerful, and desirable. He even thought he caught the edge of a longing, a very flattering and yearning thought. What a pity he is not a cat. Woodley picked up the last stone. He drew what he deserved, a sullen, scarred old tomcat with none of the verve of Captain Wow. Woodley's partner was the most animal of all the cats in the ship, a low, brutish type with a dull mind. Even telepathy had not refined his character. His ears were half chewed off in the first fights in which he had engaged. He was a serviceable fighter, nothing more. Woodley grunted. Underbill glanced at him oddly. Didn't Woodley ever do anything but grunt? Father Moontree looked at the other three. Might as well get your partners now. I'll let the scanner know that we're ready to go into the up and out. Part 3. The Deal. Underbill spun the combination lock on the Lady May's cage. He woke her gently and took her into his arms. She humped her back luxuriously, stretched her claws, started to purr, thought better of it, and licked him on the wrist instead. He did not have the pin set on, so their minds were closed to each other, but in the angle of her mustache and in the movement of her ears, he caught sense of the gratification she experienced in finding him as her partner. He talked to her in human speech, even though speech meant nothing to a cat when the pin set was not on. It's a damn shame sending a sweet thing like you whirling about in the coldness of nothing to hunt for rats that are bigger and deadlier than all of us put together. No, you didn't ask for this kind of a fight, did you? For answer, she licked his hand, purred, tickled his cheek with her long, fluffy tail, turned around and faced him, golden eyes shining. For a moment, they stared at each other, man squatting, cat standing erect on her hind legs, front claws digging into his knee. Human eyes and cat eyes looked across an immensity which no words could meet, but which affection spanned in a single glance. "Time to get in," he said. She walked docilely to her spheroid carrier. She climbed in. He saw to it that her miniature pin set rested firmly and comfortably against the base of her brain. He made sure that her claws were padded so that she could not tear herself in the excitement of battle. Softly to her, he said, "Ready?" For answer, she preened her back as much as her harness would permit and purred softly within the confines of the frame that held her. He slapped down the lid and watched the sealant ooze around the seam. For a few hours, she was welded into her projectile until a workman with a short cutting arc would remove her after she had done her duty. He picked up the entire projectile and slipped it into the ejection tube. He closed the door of the tube, spun the lock, seated himself in his chair, and put his own pin set on. Once again, he flung the switch. He sat in a small room, small, small, warm, warm. The bodies of the other three people moving close around him, the tangible lights in the ceiling bright and heavy against his closed eyelids. As the pin set warmed, the room fell away. The other people ceased to be people, and they became small, glowing heaps of fire embers, dark red fire, with a consciousness of life burning like old red coals in a country fireplace. As the pin set warmed a little more, he felt Earth just below him, felt the ship slipping away, felt the moon, turning moon, as it swung on the far side of the world, felt the planets and the hot, clear goodness of the sun, which kept the dragon so far from mankind's native ground. Finally, he reached complete awareness. He was telepathically alive to a range of millions of miles. He felt the dust which he had noticed earlier high above the ecliptic. With a thrill of warmth and tenderness, he felt the consciousness of the Lady May pouring over into his own. Her consciousness was as gentle and dear, and yet sharp to the taste of his mind, as if it were scented oil. It felt relaxing and reassuring. He could sense her welcome of him. It was scarcely a thought, just a raw emotion of greeting. At last, they were one again. In a tiny remote corner of his mind, as tiny as the smallest toy as he had ever seen in his childhood, he was still aware of the room and the ship, and of Father Moontree picking up a telephone and speaking to a go-captain in charge of the ship. His telepathic mind caught the idea long before his ears could frame the words. The actual sound followed the idea the way that thunder on an ocean beach follows the lightning inward, far out over the seas. "The fighting room is ready. Ready to clear to planoform, sir." Part 4. The Play. Underbull was always a little exasperated the way that Lady May experienced things before he did. He was braced for the quick vinegar thrill of planoforming, but he caught her report of it before his own nerves could register what happened. Earth had fallen so far away that he groped for several milliseconds before he found the sun in the upper right-hand corner of his telepathic mind. "That was a good jump," he thought. "This way we'll get here in 4 or 5 skips." A few hundred miles outside the ship, the Lady May thought back at him. "Oh, warm, oh, generous, oh, gigantic man, oh, brave, oh, friendly, oh, tender and huge partner, oh, wonderful with you so good, good, warm, warm, now to fight, now to go, good with you." He knew that she was not thinking words, that his mind took the dear, amiable babble of her cat intellect and translated it into images which his own thinking could record and understand. Neither one of them was absorbed in the game of mutual greetings. He reached out far beyond her range of perception to see if there was anything near the ship. It was funny how possible to do two things at once. He could scan space with his pin-set mind and yet at the same time catch a vagrant thought of hers, a lovely, affectionate thought about a son who had a golden face and a chest covered with soft, incredibly downy white fur. While he was still searching, he caught the warning from her. "We jump again." And so they had. The ship had moved to a second planoform. The stars were different. The sun was immeasurably far behind. Even the nearest stars were barely in contact. This was good dragon country, this open, nasty, hollow kind of space. He reached farther, faster, sensing and looking for danger, ready to fling the Lady May in danger wherever he found it. Terror blazed up in his mind, so sharp, so clear that it came through as a physical wrench. The little girl named West had found something, something immense, long, black, sharp, greedy, horrific. She flung Captain Wow at it. Underbill tried to keep his own mind clear. "Watch out!" he shouted telepathically at the others, trying to move the Lady May around. At one corner of the battle, he felt the lustful range of Captain Wow as the big Persian Tomcat detonated lights while he approached the streak of dust which threatened the ship and the people within. The lights scored near misses. The dust flattened itself, changing from the shape of a stingray into the shape of a spear. Not 3 milliseconds had elapsed. Father Moontree was talking human words and saying in a voice that moved like cold molasses out of a heavy jar, "Captain..." Underhill knew that the sentence was going to be, "Captain, move fast." The battle would be fought and finished before Father Moontree could get through talking. Now, fractions of a millisecond later, the Lady May was directly in line. Here was where the skill and the speed of the partners came in. She could react faster than he. She could see the threat as an immense rat coming directly at her. She could fire the light bombs with a discrimination which he might miss. He was connected with her mind, but he could not follow it. His consciousness absorbed the tearing wound inflicted by the alien enemy. It was like no wound on earth, raw, crazy pain, which started like a burn at his navel. He began to writhe in his chair. Actually, he had not yet had time to move a muscle when the Lady May struck back at their enemy. 5 evenly placed photonuclear bombs blazed out across 100,000 miles. The pain in his mind and body vanished. He felt a moment of fierce, terrible, feral elation running through the mind of the Lady May as she finished her kill. It was always disappointing to the cats to find out that their enemies disappeared at the moment of destruction. Then he felt her hurt, the pain and fear that swept over both of them as the battle, quicker than the movement of an eyelid, had come and gone. In the same instant there came the sharp and acid twinge of planoform. Once more, the ship went skip. He could hear Woodley thinking at him, "You don't have to bother much. This old son of a gun and I will take over for a while." Twice again the twinge, the skip. He had no idea where he was until the lights of the Caledonia spaceport shone below. With a weariness that lay almost beyond the limits of thought, he threw his mind back into support with the pin set, fixing the Lady May's projectile gently and neatly in its launching tube. She was half dead with fatigue, but he could feel the beat of her heart, could listen to her panting, and he grasped the grateful edge of a thanks reaching from her mind to his. Part 5. The Score. They put him in the hospital at Caledonia. The doctor was friendly but firm. "You actually got touched by that dragon. That's as close a shave as ever I have seen. It's all so quick that it'll be a long time before we know what happened scientifically. But I suppose you'll be ready for the insane asylum now if the contact had lasted several tenths of a millisecond longer. What kind of a cat did you have out in front of you?" Underbill felt the words coming out of him slowly. Words were such a lot of trouble compared with the speed and joy of thinking. Fast and sharp and clear, mind to mind, but words were all that could reach ordinary people like this doctor. His mouth moved heavily as he articulated words. Don't call our partners cats. The right thing to call them is partners. They fight for us. In a team. You ought to know that we call them partners, not cats. How is mine?" "I don't know," said the doctor contritely. "We'll find out for you. Meanwhile, old man, you take it easy. There's nothing but rest that can help you. Can you make yourself sleep, or would you like us to give you some kind of sedative?
I can sleep, said Underbill. I just want to know about the Lady May.
The nurse joined in. She was a little antagonistic.
Don't you want to know about the other people?
They're okay, said Underbill. I knew that before I came in here. He stretched his arms and sighed and grinned at them. He could see they were relaxing and were beginning to treat him as a person instead of a patient.
I'm all right, he said. Just let me know when I can go see my partner.
A new thought struck him. He looked wildly at the doctor. They didn't send her off with the ship, did they?
I'll find out right away, said the doctor.
He gave Underbill a reassuring squeeze of the shoulder and left the room. The nurse took a napkin off a goblet of chilled fruit juice. Underbill tried to smile at her. There seemed to be something wrong with her. He wished she would go away. First she had started to be friendly. Now she was distant again. It's a nuisance being telepathic, he thought. You keep trying to reach even when you're not making contact. Suddenly, she swung around on him.
You pinlighters, you and your damn cats!
Just as she stamped out, he burst into her mind. He saw himself a radiant hero, clad in his smooth suede uniform, the pin-set crown shining like ancient royal jewels around his head. He saw his own face, handsome and masculine, shining out of her mind. He saw himself very far away, and he saw himself as she hated him. She hated him in the secrecy of her own mind. She hated him because he was, she thought, proud and strange and rich, better and more beautiful than people like her. He cut off the sight of her mind, and as he buried his face in the pillow, he caught an image of the Lady May. She is a cat. He thought that's all that she is, a cat. But that was not how his mind saw her. Quick beyond of all dreams of speed, sharp, clever, unbelievably graceful, beautiful, wordless, and undemanding. Where would he ever find a woman who could compare with her? The Game of Rat and Dragon by Cordwainer Smith. This is WBAI New York City. The program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. If you'd like to discuss that story, give us a call at 212-209-2900. I'm going to take a rest for a couple of minutes. After the song, we'll take calls.
Are you blind when you're born?
Can you see in the dark?
Can you look at a king? Would you sit on his throne? Can you say of your bite that it's worse than your bark? Are you cock of the walk?
When you're walking alone,
because Jellicles are Jellicles do. Jellicles
would, Jellicles
can, Jellicles can and
Jellicles
do.
When you fall on your head, do you land on your feet?
Are you tense when you sense there's a storm in the air?
Can you find your way blind when you're lost in the street?
Do you know how to go to the heavy side layer?
Jellicles can.
Can you ride on the broomstick
to places far distant,
familiar with candle, with book and with bell.
Were you Whittington's friend,
the Pied Piper's assistant?
Have you been an alumnus of heaven and hell?
Are you mean like minx?
Are you mean like a lynx? Are you keen to be seen when you're smelling a rat?
Were you there when the pharaohs commissioned the Sphinx?
If you were, if you are, you're a Jericho cat. Jericho, some good Jericho cats. 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 Bring it down the air like a flying trapeze. We can turn all the somersaults back on the time. We can run up the wall, we can swing through the trees. We can balance the stars, we can run on the wire.
And again, this is WBAI in New York City. The program is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund, and we just heard a live reading of The Game of Rat and Dragon by Cord Wainer Smith. I hope you enjoyed that story. It's an amazing story, partly because it is at the same time dense and clear. Sometimes it really comes through after the next reading. You can get a copy out of Project Gutenberg. By the way, go to gutenberg.org on the internet, and that is a repository, as the name would imply, of a great deal of literature. Why it's in there, I'm not sure. But there it is, and you can read it and reread it, and perhaps other stories by Cord Wainer Smith, but I strongly, strongly recommend the complete stories of Cord Wainer Smith and read them in order. They make up this amazing, intense, vast history. Some of them total comedy, some of them horror, outright horror stories in the classic sense of the word horror. But the thinking and depth, especially the concept of alien minds that Smith incorporates into his work. Alien meaning unknowable, not human, truly. Just continues to excite me all the time. So if you'd like to call up and discuss this, the telephone number here at WBAI is 212-209-2900. And oh, there was one other thing I was going to mention or caution, but, well, it will come to me, hopefully, before the show is over. Good morning. You're on the air.
You were brilliant in that reading. I could not get
I was lousy. I stumbled
you
throughout.
Not.
Well,
please.
I felt so rusty.
Allow me to speak for a couple of seconds.
Go
please.
Ahead.
You made a couple of minor mistakes, okay? At one point, instead of reading moon, you read burning moon, then you corrected it to moon. Such like mistakes just require maybe another rehearsal. I suggest you put this on DVD and use it as a premium. This is the first time I recall that you have read, which was in the back of my mind, when is he going to read again? Here you are.
I used to read almost every show. I don't do it so much anymore.
Why?
Why? Because of the internet.
I see.
If I read, especially when the show was on at 5 a.m.,
right,
it went out over the air and it was done with. Nowadays, with the internet, my readings are there for at least the WBAI stream for two weeks and through the internet possibly longer, possibly forever.
Right.
So the rights issues are totally different than they used to be.
What and issues?
Copyright.
Oh, uh-huh.
So, you know, time was that I could, you know, that I had an understanding with a lot of the writers,
right,
et cetera, et cetera. And frankly, I could get away with some of it. Not today. not with the new technologies that are around. It is really not, you know, unless I get express permission from the writers, that's a public domain story. So I was able to get away with it. Uh-huh. So the answer of how often I do it, well, just, you know, there was, as I said, there was a time when almost every show I used to read, and I miss those days. But alas, with today's technology, it's unwise. And
how much time, rehearsal time, did you put into this piece?
That was cold.
Wow! Okay, just one minor directorial correction.
Okay.
There was too much of a pause between each part. I think it would have been
There was a very long pause. Yes. What you have to know is that I was working the computer.
I don't care. I don't care what you were. I think it would work better if you said end of part one. Part two.
Yeah, I hadn't considered that. That's a good idea.
A long pause. I said, where did he go? What happened?
That's a good idea. I should, if I had said end of part one, that might have helped. You're absolutely right.
One more thing. It's
an excellent thought. Thank you.
One more thing.
Yeah.
It was a terrific reading, despite what you think.
Yeah.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye. Take care. Thanks. Now, you see, what I know that the caller does not know is I know where words were skipped. I know when I inverted words in a line and things like that. A performer is always aware of those things. I'm glad it came out okay, but you have no idea how much of that was masking. And if I counted the mistakes in there, I guarantee that there were 30 if there was one. But thank you. I hope you enjoyed it. 212-209-2900. Good morning, listener.
Good morning.
How are you, sir?
Not bad.
Very good. And good morning, caller. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi. How are you?
Very good. I concur that you did a great reading of the story because I read it previously in the collected short stories from the NLS talking book, and I got much more out of it reading it, your reading, than I did that other reading.
What is NLS?
National Library Service for the Blind.
Ah, you know, I've always intended, and I really should go, and do they just take people who come in and donate services?
No, you usually have to be an actor. You usually have to belong to the union.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I can say I've been doing this on the radio for 40 years. Doesn't that count?
I don't think so, but you might try it, because they certainly pay well.
Oh, I'd do it for free, but if they pay, I wouldn't turn that down either.
They certainly do.
Yeah.
But they usually have very good readers, but and that's one of the better stories that I thought was in that collection, although there were other good ones. I mean,
but what collection was that?
Oh, I believe it was the one you mentioned, the complete short stories.
Oh, okay. So of Smith.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I think that's one of his best stories. He's got a lot of good stories, but I think that one rises to the top.
I mean, my favorite one is the Kamal one.
Oh, God.
That's my favorite one. But,
yeah.
The
Ballad of Lost Kamal.
Yes.
Yeah. And which further takes the whole cat thing.
Absolutely.
And brings it what happens in the history of the instrumentality of mankind. I'm telling listeners because you already know this, is that cats actually become sentient and most important parts of not humanity, but rather the instrumentality. And anybody with a C apostrophe at the start of their name has cat in their background. But they are sort of human, the same way, you know, but based on cats.
Well, I was very happy to hear you read again, and I just wanted to tell you how good it was.
Oh, thank you so much.
Take care.
Take care. Bye. Have a good morning. Bye-bye. Oh, gee, I'm getting, you know, like my ego wasn't bad enough before, huh? Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning, Robert.
For some strange reason, I was thinking of that particular story because I am currently reading a wonderful collection that Nightshade Books published called Tales,
mm-hmm.
with an I,
yeah,
of Wonder and Imagination, which is, I guess, cat reprints from the 80s to the present.
Who edited that?
Ellen Datlow.
Oh, it is Datlow, yeah. Because she's done a number of cat anthologies.
Yes, and one of them...
She's very cat-oriented.
Yes, and one of them was also called Twisted Tales of the Cat or something, which came out in 96.
It's called just Twisted Tales.
Or Twisted Tales, with an I, I'm assuming.
Yeah, well, of course.
And it actually had a couple of the collections. You know, for some reason, I don't know if it's instinct, but cat-human connections, because right now I'm in the middle of a story, a very futuristic retelling of Puss in Boots. And for some strange reason, it seems that cat-human connections seem to be the best of all the human-animal combinations.
In fiction, certainly. And you don't find as many dogs in the written word. In movies, yes, in movies.
Dogs?
Dogs.
As much as cats.
More than cats.
More than cats.
Absolutely more than cats. But in fiction, it's cats. I think writers have cats around their house, and movie makers probably have dogs. Also, they can train the dogs to do stuff in the movies. There is no way.
Either
thank you, Lister.
Cat.
There's no, oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean, ever hear the expression, herding cats?
No.
Oh, well, it's an expression. Trying to get the WBAI people to do anything with a common mind is like herding cats.
Oh, I've heard of something about being in a room full of cats, long-tailed cats with a rocking chair or something, but that's...
Well, that's a whole different thing.
Now, the interesting thing is that particular story, if my memory is right, has been anthologized a lot.
Yes.
I can think of at least three cat collections it's in, never mind science fiction collections.
Yeah, so, I mean, yeah, it's up there. It's one, it's clearly, if I had to list 100 of my favorite short stories in SF, that one will be in the, you know, will be one of the first I would name.
You know, I remember, it had to be the 60s, because that's when Galaxy Magazine, you could actually get it in Braille. And that Galaxy Magazine had a lot of Cordwainer Smith instrumentality stories.
Mm-hmm.
I can think of one called On the Gem Planet. There was another one. And it mentioned the C apostrophe. I believe he referred to those as the under people.
Yeah, well, all animal-based people are initially totally discriminated against because they're not pure human.
Right.
So they are the under people. Absolutely. There's a great deal about class structure and racism. Limebarger, who was also an expert in Asian studies.
Yes, he was.
Used a great deal of his knowledge of political science and applied that to his science fiction.
And in fact, the term I believe he used for the Santa Clara drug was strewn.
Yes.
And apparently only the Lords...
That's a colloquial term. I forget what it's actually called, you know, the long phrase for it.
And yeah. I believe only the instrumentality lords had this. They had the monopoly on this drug.
Right.
Which meant that they were, what, almost immortal?
Yeah, initially. Initially. And remember how long a history. This goes into such a far-flung future that, you know, nothing ever stays the same.
It would be interesting to read the early stories. You said it started before World War II?
Some of the stories are set pre-World War II, yes.
It would be interesting.
In German.
Anyway, that was a great story to read at 2 in the morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Take care. And good morning. You're on the radio. Yellow.
Hello, Jim.
Hi there. You're on the air.
Thank you so much. Sorry, I'm a little... The delay over the internet is much longer than the one, you know, over a radio. So I get I still hear you talking to the other guy.
Yeah, right. And actually, the delay in here is bizarre. When I go out into the reception area, it's about 20 seconds just here. So the internet, it must be even longer.
Well, I just wanted to thank you. That was such a moving story, and it was so well read. And, you know, you can say what you want, and I know as a performer, you always catch things that the audience doesn't, but it was a very touching experience hearing it over the air, and I just wanted to thank you.
I'm glad. Well, I'm grateful, especially because, as I admitted, that was a cold reading. I've not read that story in, a minimum of 5 years, if not more, aloud or to myself. That's always dangerous.
Wow, he was wonderful. I have sentimental reasons for it hitting so strongly right now because we lost our cat last month.
I'm sorry to hear that.
But, wow.
I had cats, and I was allergic to them. But, you know, there was no getting rid of them because you bond.
You just
bond. And they very, very much, they are part of your life. I grew up with a dog, and that was meaningful. But there's something about the bonding with cats and the mind. And Smith got that somehow. He really did.
I know. It's so true. Is this work in the public domain?
That particular one is.
I suppose that lowers the risk a little bit. Anyway.
Or it could be an orphaned work. I'm not sure which. Although I know Smith's daughters are alive.
Uh-huh.
And certainly very protective of his work. But why that one is in Project Gutenberg, I am not sure. But for some reason, it is there on the internet and therefore available.
So,
and legally on the internet, not, you know, it's Project Gutenberg. It's not somebody's website.
Right, exactly. So I have to assume it's relatively safe to read public domain or uncopyrighted works as opposed to, you know, stuff that's still in print.
Well, uncopyrighted is unclear. But that work is in print because it's in publication from NESFA, but the story itself is not protected for some reason. I didn't check out why, but I did see that it was available online on the internet scant hours ago. I only decided to bring that with me about midnight when I left home to come here.
I remember I remember a time that, you were sort of forced to read it on the air because you didn't have access to what you were going to read. Your guest didn't show up.
Have
it with you on the subway, and it was so well received, you ended up doing a whole Cord Wainer Smith retrospective.
Well, yeah, I did, and I still have this fantasy in my mind. If there were the money and the resources and stuff, I have this fantasy of creating the complete radio drama of the entire instrumentality of mankind, doing something like, you can't do story by story. Some of them are novels and some of them are very short stories. So my idea would be to script it in something like half hour increments.
Wow, that would be great.
And you know, that would be like, you know, something like 50 episodes. But boy, that would take a budget. Quite a budget.
Sure. Well,
one that WBAI right now doesn't have.
At the very least, the novels would have to be adapted. You know?
Oh, it all would have to be adapted. Yeah. I've even spoken to people who could do the adaptation. I've carried this thought out to the speaking stage, but that's as far as it has gone because it really is, sad to say, wishful thinking at this point.
Well, I have to say, it is brutally hard to catch the show at the time slot it's in now, but it was so worth it tonight.
Well, thank you.
Just wanted to thank you again.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Have a good morning. And a reminder to people, by the way, if you didn't catch the show now, you can catch it then. The up and out, archive.wbai.org, or go to my website, ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF, and I have a link to the part of the WBAI archive that is just Hour of the Wolf. And good morning, you're on the radio.
Jack London wrote a short story called The Last Match. In which he and his last sled dog were trying to find civilization. If you do take up that project, it's not expensive at all. There's you must find a director you can work with.
Don't
self-direct.
Okay, if I was doing it, I wouldn't be acting. So I can direct. B, I have directors and I have actors, but it is an expensive proposition. And you also have to pay writers.
I am a member of Actors Equity and the Screen Actors Guild.
That's very nice. I'm AFTRA.
What's that?
I'm AFTRA.
Oh, good.
And I was a talent residuals clerk for 8 years.
A what?
A talent residuals clerk. In other words,
what is that?
If you're in those unions, you better know what TNR is. Talent residuals clerk is the person who makes sure that the union payments are correct, that union requirements were met, and that the actor gets paid.
Good.
And a TNR person works generally for the agent or manager of an actor and disperses the money to the actor, keeping, of course, 10% for the agency.
You gave a lecture at a publishing company I worked at 20 years ago called Auerbach Publishers, One Penn Plaza. Do you recall that?
I do not.
Well, you did.
Okay.
And what you talked about mostly was something I am trying to get, your cat. Good night, Jim.
Okay, I don't think that was me. I think that was somebody else. Because I would remember such a thing. I remember the lectures I have given, and that's also not a topic I have ever done. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi there. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Not too bad. I'm afraid we're short on time.
Let me comment on the new Doctor Who. What happened to Paul Cornell? Because he did some of the better novelizations. I think when they were...
Didn't he just win a Hugo a few days ago?
Gee, that's what I'm saying. Did he do any new Doctor Who's?
Since
the Scarecrow? Well, I forget the name of that. I'm not putting the pin
Human
on,
Nature. That's called Human Nature, and boy, was that great.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. He did. I loved his writing. He did some really good stuff with Doctor Who, and I, you know, every time I saw his name, I was like, okay, I'm grabbing this one.
I would have looked it up.
Maybe he did some Sylvester McCoy episode, maybe?
Oh, he's been around for years and years.
He was back then?
Yeah.
Well, which episode did he do? Because I'm just like, you know, I'm literally spacing on it.
So am I, and with 1 minute left before I have to get off the air, I can't look it up.
That's all right.
I just
want to comment on I was watching a David Tennant episode and thinking, like, you know, that's my Doctor compared to, like, the one I'm watching now.
Well, mine is still Tom Baker, but...
Yeah, well, I still like Patrick Troughton. There was one where
he was wonderful. And
did you see the one where they actually took the missing episodes and they animated them?
That's a Douglas Adams episode. Shada, yes.
No, not Shada. It was a Patrick Troughton Invasion Cyberman episode. And
that's fandom.
Yeah.
Yeah, by the way, paulcornell.com is the place to go.
Yeah, I got none of those. I'm a Luddite.
Okay.
I don't have the patience for that.
You can...
Got enough goggle boxes in life.
Yeah, well, you can go to
Even
a library or something.
But he has his
he has his blog.
Another thing, do you remember the science fiction bookshop? Was that you back in the day with the Zardoz kiosk?
I was the stock boy there.
The Zardoz kiosk, you remember that?
Actually, I do, God help me.
That's going to be the name of a science fiction anthology. I copyrighted right now.
Oh, okay.
Not kidding, I'm only kidding.
I guess, yeah.
You can use it if you pay me. Anyway, yeah, I love the.
But I was the stock boy. Beth Meesham was the cashier. Baird Searles, of course, the owner.
Yeah.
It was all, you know, from BAI people. And and Martin Last, of course, who just passed away a couple of years ago, more or less ran the place with Baird. Oop. I'm sorry. I missed what you said. I potted you down accidentally.
I did not say anything.
Oh, okay.
I was listening to you for once.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. But, so Paul Cornell had not written any current episodes.
Not that I can think of offhand. But the one, you know, you reminded me of that two-parter, Human Nature, with the watch and all that. That was,
you didn't read any of the New Generation ones, right?
No.
What am I saying? New Generation, the New Adventures or whatever they were called. Between, you know, when McCoy... And it was sad because, McGann never got any chance.
He never got a chance.
He also moved to, talk about reality.
He did a lot of radio. He did a lot of radio episodes.
He had to move his family to the west coast of the U.S.
Yeah.
So he had to uproot his family, and they didn't even, for reasons.
Well,
I kind of liked Eric Roberts as the master.
Oh, I hated him.
Oh, it was so perverse. I kind of like... like him a little bit.
I didn't care for, I mean, I love John Sims as an actor, but he wasn't right for the part.
He's not quite Christopher Walken, but he's an incredible simulation. There's always like somebody like, you know, there's Richard Widmark, and then there's Lee Marvin. There's always somebody they can get, I was just looking at a book where they have actors.
I am so out of time.
That's all right.
So I'm sorry, I have to cut us off.
Okay.
Okay, take care. Thanks. Oh, gee, I wish I could do this for a longer time. Didn't get to bring up the topic that I talked about earlier, but you can write me, jim@ourwolf.com. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister. I will be back next week from 1:30 to 3 a.m. Not yet an agenda set. It might be another freeform program like this morning, or I may have a very, very special guest. Stay tuned. Have a wonderful week. Good morning.
Overcrowded classrooms, budget cuts, endless data testing. It's time to reverse the trends for teachers and the school system. From August 23rd to 25th, attend Teachers Unite to build the skills to empower and bring justice to our school community. For more information, contact teachersunite.net or call 212-675-4790.
We had amazing, delicious donations for our hardworking volunteers during the WBAI July fundraiser, and we just have to thank these restaurants for all they do. Lifetime Natural Market at 410 Avenue of the Americas between 9th and 10th Street, Brick NYC at 22 Warren Street, the Angelica Kitchen at 300 East 12th Street, Adrian's Pizza Bar at 54 Stone Street downtown, Le Al, this is Anthony Bourdain's place at 411 Park Avenue South at 29th Street. Calustian's Specialty Foods at 123 Lexington Avenue and 28th Street. When you stop at these great places for a bite, please give these managers a big hug from all of us at WBAI.
When I leave, you're going to know my says with the last words on my lips. I am a revolutionary. And you're gonna have to keep on saying that. You're gonna have to say that I am a proletarian. I am
the
bitch.
The red, white, and blue spit on you.
Expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's all the way I see it. While I'm going off berserk, cause the system work to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pigs work. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my writing. It's writing the Constitution. Yo, that's an illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm no lover of this flag like many others take the same turn like me. They yearn for the flag too.
Listen
to the material of the imperialist in a blazing inferno. Cause my hurt is internal. The American dream, a nightmare. I want the people to wake up to the lies the pigs make up. Imperialistic swans that I grind into bacon bits. Call the fist cause I ain't taking shit. I'm not a Nazi or a Cappy or a Farmy, but you want me in prison cause I'm busy attacking the flag. I ragging and snagging and dragging and
rip it to shreds. Cause I'm too black, too strong, too red, too dread. And I'm dreaded cause I make the pigs tremble when I burn a symbol. Yo, I'm quick and nimble like Jack, but I'm a black man attacking the flag. I keep my torch handy, I'm no Yankee Doodle Dandy. So just hand me a flag from the fastest and watch me burn that piece of to ashes. Cause the real meaning is what the masses must learn. That's why the red, white, and blue must burn, baby, burn.
He looked so neat. He's a real hard man, tough as they come. He said I was cool, but I still felt like an old boiler. He bid me come out.
how could I say no? He said, meet me at 8, round at my place, you know, with my new gear on and a blow-dried hairdo. But in my mind I knew I was still an old boiler. We danced all night long to a nice steady beat, but my hair went to frizz in the terrible heat. My mascara ran and so did my tights, confirming in my sight I must be an old boiler. So we came out of this club,
1995, WBAI.
So we've been dancing all night. And he says to me, whoa, babe, what you doing then? Well, I think I might get a cab. I said casually, ah, no, no, come back to my place. And he lived just round the corner, you can go home in the morning, yeah? Well, I don't think so, I mean, I've only known you a day, it's a bit soon, isn't it? Give me a ring sometime, yeah? But then he starts to get mad. Listen here, girl. I bought that gear you got on. I paid you in here tonight. I bought you all them drinks and you want to go home, I should be with you, Coco.
99.5 WBAI.
Well, I felt a right mug. Well, you would, wouldn't you? So I ran after him, caught him up. There we are, walking down the street about 100 miles per hour, arm in arm. No talking, atmosphere you could have cut with a knife. There was no one about, nothing to take your mind off it, you know, no cars, not even the occasional stray animal.
This is Burn Baby Burn.
It was cold and winds whistling through the trees, and blowing newspapers against my legs, so I tripped as I tried to keep up with him. All these little alleyways and railway bridges stink of piss. Then all of a sudden he grabbed hold of my arm and he starts to drag me up one of these alleyways and he starts to hit me really hard across the face, you know. He was hitting me and grabbing at me. It was awful because I was so big. Me wasn't tearing at my clothes. There was nothing I could do, honest. I was helpless. And then he tried to rape me, and there was nothing I could do, honest. All I could do was scream.
Minutes after 3 o'clock, 99 Sinker list alive until 5 o'clock. Al Jazeera English kicks in. Yeah. playing all the reggae music them reggae shows refuse to play, y'all. 212-209-2900. Here we go. 25 years to be carefree.